Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, April 20th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor's column, and then I'll read On the Cover. Following that, we'll do Our World, Reporters on the Job, The Explainer, The Home Forum, and the editorials. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor's column is entitled Bearing Arms, Shifting Views of a Foundational Right. This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who's the print editor. And you can email her at haness@csmonitor.com. And she writes, Reporter Patrick Johnson has been writing about guns for 15 years. As the Monitor's beat reporter in the American Southeast, Patrick has covered gun violence and gun rights, coffee shops banning firearms and stand-your-ground law advocates using them, mass shootings and the National Rifle Association, and whether the gun itself has become a sacred object in America. In this week's magazine, he writes about a new twist in what has become one of the country's most emotional and debated issues, a growing liberal embrace not just of guns themselves, but of an approach to the Second Amendment long associated with the conservative right. I've covered so many angles on the Second Amendment, Patrick told me. I've done stories about liberal gun owners. I did a story about women gun owners. I did a story about complications of being a black gun owner. But Patrick started noticing something new after the killing of Alex Pretty, an intensive care nurse fatally shot by federal agents in Minnesota earlier this year. During the COVID-19 pandemic and a wave of Black Lives Matter protests, Patrick explains, a growing number and diversity of Americans started turning to firearms in hopes of defending themselves from criminals. This, according to scholars, was an expansion of what is sometimes called gun culture 2.0, a perception of guns as being primarily for self-protection rather than for hunting or military use. Previously, those on the left were more likely to identify with gun control advocates who point to research showing that firearms in a home increase the risk of violence there. After Minnesota, though, Patrick found a growing cross-partisan belief that guns are necessary not just to protect oneself from criminals, but also from the government. Mr. Pretty had been carrying a licensed handgun, a fact used by some government officials to at first justify his shooting and later raised by citizens across the political spectrum worried about federal overreach. What happened after Alex Pretty was this simmering sense on the left that maybe the folks on the right were correct. What if the state falls into the wrong hands? Patrick told me. He started to look for data, he says, and found early indications that thought might be shifting. This is at the heart of the story, this rethinking of the Second Amendment on the left and what that means, Patrick says. That was the From the Editor's column this week written by Stephanie Haynes, who is the print editor. And this week was entitled Bearing Arms, Shifting Views of a Foundational Right. And now for On the Cover. This is going to be a very short article. But anyway, it says, more liberals are buying guns. Why? Rising gun ownership among Democrats is reshaping U.S. gun culture and recalibrating the debate between gun rights, civic safety, and government control. This is written by Patrick Johnson, who is a staff writer. From Rome, Georgia. On a hillside outside Rome, Georgia, a sign on a small building announces a firm called Osprey Shooting Solutions, whose Latin motto translates to, in peace, like a wise man, he should make suitable preparation for war. Next door is a dusty gun range where a man practices quick draw fire with a trainer behind him. The pop, pop, pop of small arms fire fills the air. Rural ranges like this have often been seen as a purview of white conservative men, some of whom style themselves as citizen protectors. Yet owner Edgar Mills, a former Green Beret soldier, is a key player in what has become a noticeable shift in who owns firearms in the United States and why. In the last couple of years, a growing number of women and people of color have begun training with Mr. Mills. His clients are conservatives, moderates, liberals, and those who defy simple labels altogether. His star student is Eva, a former infantry soldier who appears at the range in pink stockings and painted nails. In some ways, Mr. Mills' expansive view of gun ownership is still unusual in a firearm culture often associated with support for President Donald Trump and his villainization of Democrats and progressive politics. Yet those who see the Second Amendment's right to bear arms as a bulwark against oppressive government are beginning to include liberals who increasingly find themselves in political and social crosshairs. Laying out the welcome mat to Democrats and others who don't fit a traditional conservative gun owner profile has become good business, especially at a time when gun sales, which peaked at about 22 million in 2020, have slowed. Gun owners who lean left politically are looking for an accepting place where people aren't stink-eyeing them, says Mr. Mills, whose solid physique hints at years of war zone deployments. Nobody wants to be in an environment where they're not wanted. Across the U.S., gun ownership by people who identify as politically left of center are rising. One NBC News survey showed that the number of Democratic households with guns rose from 33% in 2019 to 41% 5 years later. Other studies confirm that gun culture is now far more diverse than is often portrayed in the media, and that Second Amendment activism is a key driver for many new gun owners. Current events and politics, experts and observers say, are playing a role in who carries what and why. A trend that began with women and black people outbuying white men at gun shops during the COVID-19 pandemic accelerated with the fatal shooting of Alex Priddy in Minneapolis in January, according to liberal gun rights groups. A legal gun carrier who never drew his weapon, Mr. Priddy, was killed as he tried to help a woman knocked down by federal immigration enforcement agents. His death raised the stakes among some left-leaning Americans worried about armed agents trampling their civil rights. In the process, some Americans have shifted from opposing guns to embracing them, setting up new political dynamics in a restive America. What has changed with Trump's second term and the Alex Priddy incident is the idea that guns aren't just for personal self-defense, but may also be to resist government tyranny, says David Yamane, author of Gun Curious, A Liberal Professor's Surprising Journey Inside America's Gun Culture. This becomes a challenge for a lot of centrist liberals because they place a lot of faith in the state, he adds. Then they see what could go wrong if the state falls into the wrong hands. Why buy a gun? Broadly, polls consistently show that Republicans support gun ownership at much higher rates than Democrats. At the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, one banner showed a Confederate battle flag with an assault-style weapon and the taunt, "Come and take it." Democrats, by contrast, traditionally favor stricter gun laws. In 2019, when former Texas Republican Beto O'Rourke declared, "Hell, yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AR-40 or AK-47 at a Democrat presidential primary debate to endorse a mandatory buyback program for assault-style weapons, the audience's cheer drowned out the rest of his answer. But in recent years, gun ownership as a political statement and for political reasons has accelerated, with more citing the need for self-defense and liberal gun organizations seeing heightened interest. That sales growth has blunted the Trump slump for the firearms industry, which usually sees lower sales when gun owners feel confident that the new president is protecting gun carry rights. Professor Yamane, a sociologist at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, began studying gun culture a decade ago to understand its mainstream appeal. To better understand it, he ended up buying a gun himself. The move was unusual and unpopular among his peers, he says, and has been a solitary experience. But he is not so lonely anymore. While gun sales have fallen from a high water mark in 2021, annual sales still hover around 15 million each year and are still higher than before the pandemic, according to The Trace, a nonprofit publication that reports on U.S. gun violence. Nearly 5 million guns were sold in the first 4 months of 2025, it says. LA Progressive Shooters, a gun education group in Los Angeles that welcomes people regardless of their politics, has had to expand its increasingly sold-out training sessions. Another nationwide group based in Newton, Massachusetts, the Liberal Gun Club, saw its membership rise by 66% from 2,700 members to 4,500 in the year before Mr. Preddy's shooting. The organization passed its total 2025 training numbers in the first 3 months of 2026. Some of the new gun groups eschew political affiliations. Others cater mostly to liberals. In Shelton, Connecticut, for example, an organization named A Better Way 2A promotes gun rights for progressives and sells a variety of merchandise, including stickers that say, "You can't vote away fascism, buy a gun." The Socialist Rifle Association, founded in Kansas in 2018, claims 10,000 donors and says it seeks to advance an inclusive, safe, and healthy firearms culture in America to combat the toxic, right-wing, and exclusionary firearm culture in place today. Owning a gun now is not an automatic indicator that you're most likely a conservative, says Jordan Levine, co-founder of A Better Way 2A. You have far more people who are politically involved, Gen Z and millennials especially, who see things and feel this dread that your most paranoid conservative gun owners have felt for so long. But now, it's not liberals coming for your guns, but conservatives coming for our rights. Different views among Democrats. For those who see guns as problems, not solutions, the trend is jarring. Most researchers agree that stricter gun laws save lives, though Americans are still split on whether gun rights or gun control is more important. Now, with the public on high alert about armed federal immigration enforcement, that debate, once confined largely to political circles, is now on Main Street. There's something that has been lost with the aggressiveness of what's happening, says Drew Stevenson, a professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston. We don't know where the boundaries are anymore, and where do they stop? The shootings in January of Mr. Preddy and Renee Good in Minneapolis have crystallized those concerns and turned arguments for stricter gun rights upside down. Conservatives' concerns, once fueled in part by the National Rifle Association's descriptions of federal agents as jackbooted government thugs, became visceral for liberals who watched the Trump administration's immigration crackdown in Minnesota. Mr. Preddy was hailed as a hero among those on the political left for defending his community against federal agents carrying out a deportation agenda in a way many believe clashed with local values. Videos have since emerged of armed Minnesotans standing guard in neighborhoods, including one in which a gun carrier says, "This is my area. I protect my people." Many liberals identified with those protesting, says Edward Gardner, head of the Liberal Gun Club in Massachusetts. Renee Good looked like a middle-aged soccer mom. Alex Preddy looked like an average white guy with a beard. The killings twinged something in people's brains. If it can happen to them, it can happen to me. Guns as a common cause. But the question of whether calls for gun rights and regulations are evenly applied is a nuance embedded in the legal arc of the Second Amendment in American history. The amendment has always been messy. The Founding Fathers wrote it in part to discourage tyrannical government, but in practice it was mostly used to justify repelling Indian attacks on settlements and, in the South, to intimidate abolitionists. The Second Amendment might also be a reminder to respect other people's spaces, suggesting a broader notion, as Mr. Mills, Osprey's owner, puts it, that an armed society that is ready to defend itself may, in fact, be a better society. For Mr. Mills, preserving expanded gun rights helps protect all Americans from government overreach. Not that he doesn't worry about gun safety for the public at large, but that's a quandary, he says, he cannot solve. What we know about the government is if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Our World in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. And according to what they say right here, this is a global news roundup compiled by the Monitor's international team. So the first one, we should never forget what happened here. That's former political prisoner Jesus Armas discussing El Helicoide, Venezuela's notorious detention center, with NPR. Nearly 4 months after the United States captured Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, the country is facing difficult questions on how to reestablish democracy, and El Helicoide's future is under discussion. A former shopping mall, it was built in the 1950s and became a torture site for the Bolivian National Intelligence Service in the 2010s. Acting President Delcy Rodriguez proposed that it become a sports complex for low-income residents. Opposition members see that as an erasure of state crimes. And that was written by Whitney Ulick. And our next one here is a vote on the gravest crime against humanity. As pressure builds on Western nations to atone for its historical wrongs, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution in March calling the transatlantic slave trade the gravest crime against humanity and urging that reparations be paid to affected societies. 123 countries voted in favor of the measure, which Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama called a route to healing. 52 others, including all European Union members, abstained. Israel, Argentina, and the United States voted against the measure, with the U.S. government saying that it does not support reparations for actions that were not illegal at the time they occurred. General Assembly resolutions are not legally binding. And that was written by Ryan Lenora Brown. Our next one here, China's gig economy boom. Flexible employment, as gig work is known in China, has surged. From delivery and ride-hailing drivers to freelancing hard hats, gig workers now account for 27% of the total workforce of 740 million people and 43% of urban workers, according to Caixin Global, a Chinese financial news service. More Chinese job seekers, including university graduates and skilled professionals, are turning to gig jobs, which once primarily attracted blue-collar workers. High unemployment for urban young people is one factor driving the trend, but the lack of steady income and a social safety net for these employees is a drawback, and the government has yet to fill the gaps. That was written by Ann Scott Tyson. We got one more here. Breaking through bureaucracy. Harry Kruder, a researcher at the Institute for Public Values, found that social programs in the Netherlands had good motives, but rigidly bureaucratic rule-following often got in the way. In some cases, it made things worse. Now, his breakthrough method, aided by a digital tool, is helping officials in more than 100 municipalities find flexible solutions. The question is always, what solves the problem? He told Reasons to be Cheerful, an online magazine. There's almost always legal room to do what's needed. And that was written by Mark Sappenfield. And they have a note here. Have an idea for Our World? Please email ourworld@csps.com if there is an important global story that the media missed, a trend that is driving the news where you live, or a story that uplifts. The Monitor will publish reader picks from time to time. And now for Reporters on the Job in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a map of the world with points indicated on it and then a paragraph or two or sometimes three telling you about it. The first one is from Denver and it's written by Sarah Matusik. And it says, call it Christmas in spring. In late March, a belated Christmas card arrived from a former source, a Southwest rancher I'd interviewed 2 years ago. His holiday family newsletter came complete with pics of cute grandkids. I left a voicemail thanking him and said we should catch up. Other past sources who have generously shared their time came to mind, so I reached out to four. One, a Japanese-American detention camp survivor, responded with a story idea. Another, an artist, wants me to visit her soon. When so much of my day is spent solo, typing away, I'll count these connections as gifts and grist for future articles. The next one is from Lima, Peru, and it's written by Howard LaFranchi. And it says, over decades of reporting abroad, my first stop is always the nearest newspaper kiosk. It's a great way to get insight on local events, trends, and sources. On a past trip to a newsstand in Lima, Peru, a report on the death of literary giant Mario Vargas Llosa pointed me to the cafe where he had held court. Talking with regulars there became my lead. This habit has been more difficult with the decline of newspapers. Still, on a recent trip to Lima to cover its April 12th presidential election, I returned to the same kiosk in the Miraflores, a neighborhood that I had patronized before. I met Raquel, who told me she has been selling newspapers there for 45 years. Thanks for being a repeat customer, she said with a twinkle in her eye. From Rome, Georgia, get something written by Patrick Johnson. Perseverance is almost always the key to solid reporting. For a story about gun ownership, I met Edgar, a weapons trainer, at a rural shooting range. It was a good interview, and after an hour, it seemed a natural time to end. But sensing there was more to learn, I asked him a bit more about his work. He wasn't just a range coach, it turned out. He also runs urban survival scenarios to teach leadership skills. He recently ran one that featured a hunt for a rogue militia. The tale became the glue that held the story together. The wait is often worth it. And the next and last one is Rwenzori Mountain. This is from Rwenzori Mountains in Uganda, and this is written by Simon Avira. Heights make me uneasy, but somehow when the monitor asked me to report on the disappearing glaciers of Uganda for an upcoming story, it didn't quite register that glaciers tend to sit on top of mountains. To reach them, I spent 2 days in rattling buses and then hiked 5 days through the Rwenzori mountain range, dreading the final ascent. As a guide held my hands, I traversed narrow ridges and steep rock faces, regretting my life choices. But I got there eventually and feel privileged to have seen the glaciers. In 10 years, these glaciers will probably be gone, according to the scientists I interviewed, while many Ugandans who depend on their meltwater have never seen them. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is entitled, Why the U.S. Will Pay a French Company Nearly $1 Billion to Give Up Wind Farm Plans. The Trump administration's deal to pay Total Energies to shift from wind farms to U.S. fossil fuel investment fits within a strategy to restrict offshore wind industry. This is written by Cameron Pugh, who is a staff writer. In late March, the Trump administration announced it had struck an unusual deal. The U.S. government will pay Total Energies, a French power generation company, $928 million to scuttle its plans to build two wind farms off the coasts of New Jersey and North Carolina. Together, the projects could have powered some 1.7 million homes. The deal represents a new wrinkle in President Donald Trump's campaign to jettison America's nascent offshore wind industry, which many environmentalists see as key to reducing the country's carbon footprint. Mr. Trump has criticized wind power as ineffective and costly, and his administration has tried to curtail wind infrastructure development. Offshore wind is one of the most expensive, unreliable, environmentally disruptive, and subsidy-dependent schemes ever forced on American ratepayers and taxpayers, said Interior Secretary Doug Burgum in a news release announcing the deal. Environmentalists see the administration dismantling offshore wind as short-sighted and damaging to Americans' pocketbooks. While offshore wind remains more expensive to install and run than other energy sources, the costs have fallen significantly in recent years, driven by a growing interest from nations and corporations, as well as improving technology. Offshore wind costs have decreased more than 50% globally since 2013, according to a 2024 report from the U.S. Department of Energy. They are expected to keep declining as the industry becomes more established. It's also just a real hallmark of the administration's hostility to clean energy at a time when clean energy projects are some of the biggest and cheapest and fastest coming online, says Ted Kelly, director and lead counsel for the Environmental Defense Fund's Clean Energy Program. Instead of encouraging that, we're now not only discouraging it, but taxpayer money is being paid to stop it. The deal with Total Energies raises questions not only about the future of offshore wind in the United States, but also about the extent of the president's authority to influence private business transactions. Here's a look at some of the issues at play, and what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: how will the deal work? Answer: the Trump administration will essentially refund the $928 million Total Energies paid for leases to build Attentive Energy, about 40 miles off New Jersey, and Carolina Long Bay, roughly 22 miles off North Carolina. Federal law mandates these leases, which are typically acquired through a bidding process, for anyone seeking to generate electricity in the waters off the country's coasts. In exchange, the French firm has agreed to redirect that money into oil and gas projects in the United States. Those investments include Rio Grande LNG, a liquefied natural gas plant in South Texas, and unspecified oil projects in the Gulf of Mexico. In the Interior Department news release, Total Energy CEO Patrick Pouyanner was quoted as saying that fossil fuel projects are a more efficient use of capital in the United States. The company also pledged not to build any offshore wind projects in the United States, citing unspecified national security concerns. Further details about the deal, which was first reported by the New York Times, have not been made public. Environmental advocates interviewed by the Monitor say it is highly unusual for a president to transfer taxpayer funds to a foreign company to prevent private investment. Most of the revenue from offshore leases goes to the Treasury Department's general fund, which finances daily government operations. And the money Total Energies paid for the leases might have already been spent. Total Energies, one of the largest liquefied natural gas companies in the world, already has investments in the Rio Grande plant dating back to at least 2023. It's unclear how much money the company might now funnel into the Texas plant. It's also unclear from what source the Trump administration would draw the funds. Some reports have suggested the money will likely come from the Justice Department's Judgment Fund, which the government uses to pay court judgments and settlements. Neither Total Energies nor the Interior Department responded to requests for comment. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, an arm of the Interior Department, awarded Total Energies leases for both Carolina, Long Bay, and Attentive Energy in 2022. According to the leases, which are publicly available, Total Energies paid $133 million for the land encompassing Carolina Long Bay and $795 million for the territory slated to become Attentive Energy. Question: what other actions has the Trump administration taken on offshore wind? Answer: in December, the Interior Department issued a work stoppage halting construction on 5 wind farms off the East Coast. The administration cited a classified report from the Defense Department claiming offshore wind posed a national security threat. The administration also pointed to a finding in a Public Energy Department report that said turbine blades and towers can create radar interference. Radar systems raise their threshold for detection to combat this, the report says, and might miss actual targets as a result. Each of the farms sued over the work stoppage. Judges, after viewing the classified report, ruled against the government in all 5 of those cases. The classified report had not been made public, and litigation in the cases is ongoing. On his first day in office, President Trump issued an executive order temporarily suspending offshore wind leasing pending an assessment by the Interior Department. He cited the need to foster an energy economy that meets rising demand, as well as unspecified impacts on marine life, ocean currents and wind patterns, and energy costs. A federal judge in Massachusetts ruled the order unlawful in December. The Trump administration filed a notice of appeal in February. Question: what do environmentalists say about the deal? Answer: climate advocates and researchers argue that offshore wind is an effective and efficient method for generating clean energy. They've criticized the deal with Total Energies as abdication of the country's responsibility to lower greenhouse gas emissions. This is as much an attack on planet Earth relative to its ecological health as it is an attack on this particular technology, says Stephen A. Smith, executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Over its lifetime, the Energy Department says a coal-fired power plant produces 90 times more greenhouse gas emissions than a wind farm. Research suggests that offshore wind is more reliable than onshore wind because the turbines tend to be larger, and the wind is stronger, faster, and more consistent over open ocean. South Fork Wind, off the coast of New York, one of the country's few completed offshore wind projects, produced electricity more than 92% of the time during its first year of operation, according to the farm. As the war in Iran has sent oil prices soaring, Brad Campbell, president of the Conservation Law Foundation in Boston, says renewable energies like offshore wind could help insulate consumers. Offshore wind is a homegrown energy supply. We're not dependent or vulnerable to price spikes from disruption of international markets, Mr. Campbell says. It provides stability, particularly to the electric grid, when there are disruptions to oil and gas supply. And the final question, what kind of impact will the deal have on offshore wind development in the U.S.? And the final answer, with the Trump administration's offshore wind losses in court, the president might be seeking new ways to move against the industry, says Mr. Kelly from the Environmental Defense Fund. They might turn their attention to trying to prevent any more projects from getting started, he says. Mr. Campbell, who is also a lawyer, questions whether the president has the authority to conduct this kind of deal. In general, Mr. Campbell says the president cannot spend money that has not been appropriated by Congress. And now for the Home Forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There is one article, and I shall read it. It is entitled, Fix My Watch, Tell Me a Story. A visit to a vulnerable watchmaker brings out stories of watches, including an heirloom pocket watch that saved a life. This is written by Robert Close. Who even has cause to utter the word watchmaker anymore? I, for one, haven't worn a watch in many, many years, nor do most of the people I know. But a lovely gold pocket watch came down to me from my great-grandmother. Its only flaw was that it didn't run. So I asked around and was told that there was a watchmaker in Bangor, Maine, only a few miles from my home. The shop was everything I had hoped it would be. Small, intimate, with oak cabinets, specialized hand tools, and lovely old timepieces lying in state in a glass display case. The piece de resistance was the workbench, easily 100 years old. This bench, flanked by myriad small drawers, was specifically designed to place the work surface at eye level. The pull-out cloth-covered shelf was a clever touch to catch any teeny part that might fall. The watchmaker himself, a white-haired eminence grise, was bent over his work, a jeweler's loop in his eye, when I walked in. He greeted me warmly. I soon learned that Keith Tabor had been at the job for 55 years. In other words, since I was in high school. He was a legacy watchmaker, having been trained by his father, who learned the trade at the Waltham Watch Company factory in Massachusetts, now defunct. I presented my pocket watch to him. He examined it and then said two welcome words. No problem. I was moved to ask Mr. Tabor a few questions. Did people still wear watches? He asserted that they certainly did, and that wristwatches were making a comeback. Most baby boomers are now younger guys, he said. Interestingly, he attributed the uptick to the isolation induced by the COVID-19 pandemic. People stayed home. They found Grandpa's old watch. The stories took wing from there, and I perched ripe for the listening. Any interesting customers? Why, yes. About 20 years ago, the musician David Crosby walked into my shop with his wife's Rolex. He had heard about me and wound up staying for an hour. How about interesting watches? Yes, indeed. An older gentleman came in with a Panerai Rolex used by the Italian Navy in World War II. Mr. Tabor went on to explain that only 20 of these original diver's watches were made for two-person scuba teams that could go after German submarines. I asked why only 20 were made. There was too much radioactive material in the illuminating paint, so they were discontinued. These watches are priceless. The owner came in and wanted to sell it, but on further reflection, he changed his mind. And then there was the time someone brought in a Patek Philippe, the most desirable brand in the world, going for millions of dollars. I asked if he was able to fix it. Mr. Tabor's matter-of-fact response, oh yes. Perhaps the most striking story concerned an antique silver pocket watch with a deep dent in the casing. The man who brought it in was a descendant of a Civil War soldier who had carried the watch into battle. The man was shot, but the bullet struck the watch, saving his life. That fortunate event allowed the soldier's family line to continue generation upon generation. Maybe that watch was a precursor to the Kevlar vest, Mr. Tabor remarked with a chuckle. As far as Mr. Tabor knows, he's the only watchmaker between Bangor and the Canadian border. In fact, many of his customers come from these nether regions. So, business is good? I inquired. He smiled as he said, I'm busy all the time. This gladdened my heart. In this digital age, when the workings of our electronics are invisible to us, and when replace is largely done away with repair, it's important to be reminded of a time when the world was mechanical. Things were so finely tuned that it took a human eye, assisted by a jeweler's loop, to keep the nuts and bolts of daily life ticking along. Speaking of which, I picked up my great-grandmother's pocket watch 3 days later and held it to my ear. It purred like a kitten. And now we're at the editorials in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There are three of them, and I got more than enough time to read each one twice or even more. But here we go. I won't do that. Children's Innocent and the Iran War. One theme from the Iran War has been rising concern for children. More to the point, the concern is over how to safeguard their inherent innocence and propensity for peace. One example focuses on Iran's use of 12 and 13-year-olds in war-related roles, such as security patrols. A teachers' union in Iran has condemned such militarization of childhood. It warns about placing children in harm's way, which would be a violation of international child rights. For its part, the United States was criticized after an American missile struck near an Iranian girls' school, resulting in more than 170 deaths. The White House claims children are not U.S. military targets. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has launched a formal investigation of the incident. Israel has appealed to the United Nations to respond to Iran's alleged indiscriminate missile attacks on innocent civilians and children. And on March 3rd, the Security Council met to discuss the general topic of children and education during conflict. The Iran war was top of mind, starting with comments by UN Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo. When conflicts erupt, children are among those most severely affected. We have been reminded of this truth over the last 2 days, she said. Schools in Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, and Oman have closed and moved to remote learning owing to the ongoing military operations in the region. One reason for this strong spotlight on children in war lies in the expanding set of treaties and global norms over decades to protect youth in conflicts. The UN has found that many armed militias are willing to accept that the innocence of children requires they not be used as soldiers. The focus on children has also sometimes helped end wars. In recent decades, outcry over the use of child soldiers during conflicts in Sierra Leone and Liberia, for example, raised pressure on belligerents to compromise. Sierra Leone's 1991 to 2002 civil war led to the first conviction for the war crime of recruiting children, as well as attention on the rehabilitation of former child soldiers. At the same time, many current wars, including in Myanmar and Yemen, involve children as combatants. In Iran, many parents accept the regime's recruitment of children. Still, the worldwide attention on the issue might turn public attitudes to further support the safeguardings of children's innocence and perhaps help turn the tide of the war. The next editorial is Truth Seekers in Russia. After more than 4 years of war in Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin might be discovering that adherence to open communications can be essential for a motivated military. A Kremlin attempt to steadily shut down Russia's most popular and effective messaging platform, Telegram, has stirred dissent among civilian volunteers who assist the war online. They are the patriotic digital warriors who arrange money and supplies, the resources the military does not reliably provide, for soldiers on the front lines. Without access to an independent app like Telegram, which has been slowly throttled for months, this civil society of auxiliary supporters could weaken their support for the government. Morale in the army ranks might fall fast. In March, one well-known blogger, Iya Remeslor, who had been loyal to Mr. Putin, turned on the Kremlin for its strangling of internet and media freedoms. He has since been put in a psychiatric ward. Spotty access to Telegram has begun to reduce the ability of soldiers to message their families. For many Russians, an open internet is essential to send alerts about Ukrainian missile attacks. A government-backed new app, called Max, is widely seen as inadequate in its capabilities as well as an attempt to control all digital communications. All military work goes through Telegram, all communication, a Russian soldier told Politico. A total ban on the app would be like shooting the entire Russian army in the head. Frequent internet blackouts have already disrupted daily life. Memes have made fun of Russians using paper maps, pagers, and walkie-talkies. In March, protests in defense of Telegram were planned in more than 24 cities and towns, but were prevented by local officials. And as more people rush to use censor-skirting VPNs, or virtual private networks, officials are clamping down on those, too. A survey in March found 83% of teenagers have reacted negatively to the internet restrictions. Nearly half said they were angry, and 15% said they were crying. The inventor of Telegram, Russian tech billionaire Pavel Durov, said the Kremlin's moves on free speech are a sad spectacle of a state afraid of its own people. Yet his fellow citizens' response to the expected end of Telegram could end up being a force for freedom. And the same ideal of liberty, it turns out, is just what the people of Ukraine are defending. And the last one here is local bonds in a war can give peace a chance. In one of Africa's largest countries, fighting and wartime atrocities have intensified as Sudan marks 3 years of civil strife. Amid the violence as well as food scarcity, however, ordinary Sudanese continue to support each other through mutual aid networks. These humanitarian efforts, known as emergency response rooms, won a prestigious award in March from a British think tank, the Chatham House Prize. The award shines a spotlight on the effectiveness and civil underpinnings of such community associations. Sudan's war has displaced nearly 13 million people, and the emergency response rooms have sprung up to source and distribute food, water, and medicine. They often have volunteers cooking meals in open-air kitchens where fleeing families eat together. Chatham House praised the impartial nature and attempts to provide aid to all. That spirit of inclusiveness during a conflict is not confined to Sudan. In many conflict zones, such efforts help lay a groundwork for peaceful coexistence at the community level. Innovation often emerges most forcefully in fragile environments, according to Ibrahima Bokum, a community leader in the eastern part of Congo, an area riven by rebel warfare. Writing in a recent Atlantic Council report, Mr. Bokum noted, "Resilience cannot be imported. It must be cultivated locally." Peacebuilding during a violent conflict. People assume that peacebuilding only takes place after the guns have fallen silent, when in fact peacebuilding can and does take place before, during, and after a violent conflict, observed Dylan Matthews, head of the international nonprofit Peace Direct. The challenge, he wrote in a 2022 article, is to cultivate societal attitudes that foster peace. Last year, Peace Direct supported local initiatives in 33 countries, including Myanmar. There, under a dictatorship, hate speech, propaganda, and rumors kept neighbors as strangers, the organization reported. But local communities forged connections across ethnic lines, which eventually morphed into violence prevention and mutual aid networks. Observing community interactions at a very different period in history, French historian Alexis de Tocqueville identified the art of associating within local communities as a key to democracy. He was talking about the United States in the mid-1930s, several decades after it had become independent, and a couple of decades before it fought its own civil war. Through active, interactive associations within local communities, Tocqueville observed, sentiments and ideas renew themselves, the heart is enlarged, and the human mind is developed. Well, guess what? We got 10 minutes left. The on-the-cover story was very teeny. It was 3 pages, and each page had pictures, and one of them even had another column on it. Okay, so here's something called, How Do Americans See Each Other? What New Data Says About Perceptions of Morality. And researchers asked people from different countries to rank the morality and ethics of their fellow citizens. The results could offer insights on how communities can rebuild trust. And this is written by Mark Sappenfield, Sarah Miller-Lana, and Audrey Thibert, who are staff writers, and is Mira Luftfia Tisnedibrata. There you go, special contributor. And this is from Berlin, Toronto, Boston, and Jakarta, Indonesia. This year, the Pew Research Center decided to try something new. In its annual survey on global views of morality, it added a fresh question for its respondents from around the world. Do you feel the ethics and morals of others in your country are good? The United States finished last. It was the only country among the 25 surveyed where more than half of the respondents rated the ethics and morals of people in their country as somewhat bad or very bad. Canada, which usually ranks similarly to U.S. in such surveys, finished first. Some 92% of Canadians rated fellow Canadians as having somewhat good or very good ethics and morals. It was a perplexing result, running dramatically against long-time trends shown by similar studies. There's no paper out there that explains this, says Joshua Conrad Jackson, a behavioral scientist at the University of Chicago. We don't really know what's going on in a survey. Researchers are trying to piece together what it might mean. Given that this was the first time the question was ever asked, was it a blip? An outlier? Or has it unearthed something new about how Americans think about morality and each other? No one is willing to say they have the answer, but a range of theories have given fresh fuel to decades-long conversations about polarization and social trust. Do Americans increasingly see one another as unethical? Not everyone thinks that's necessarily what this survey highlights. But looking at the U.S., Canada, and Indonesia, which came in fractionally second to Canada in the Pew survey, offers insights and ideas to consider, if not definite or definitive answers. And it suggests potential ways for the U.S. Not only are moral views in one another often wrong, but America is also once a global leader in overcoming entrenched lines of division. Many theories. Part of the challenge with drawing firm conclusions from this particular survey is that researchers are not entirely sure what respondents are telling them. Morality is a difficult subject to quantify. People disagree on the definition, and some respondents deny that it is even a thing. For that reason, studies on morality are often closely linked with similar studies on ethics, kindness, or trust. In the past, these studies have revealed several findings that generally hold true across societies and over time. Respondents think the morality of those close to them is stronger than the morality of those they don't know, and they believe that morality in society is getting worse. The results of the latest Pew survey don't fit neatly into either of those trends. Adam Mastroianni, a social psychologist, who, one colleague says, knows more about this topic than anyone in the world, is stumped. It appears to be out of step with a lot of other surveys we've seen, says Dr. Mastroianni, author of the science newsletter Experimental History. But he has a theory. Here's what I think might be happening, he says in an email conversation. When you ask Canadians, how moral are Canadians? They hear that question as, how moral is Canada compared to other relevant countries? And they say, very moral, because in the news, they mainly see other countries blowing each other up. Otherwise, why would so many Canadians say other Canadians are moral, when in other surveys, Canadians routinely say nearly half of Canadians can't be trusted? Pew's Kirsten Lesage is loath to draw conclusions, even as an author of the study, but a few things stick out to her. Usually, young adults and older adults have broadly similar views on trends in morality, but on this question, younger adults in the U.S. were an outlier. They were more likely to see other Americans as having bad morals and ethics. Pew has data on Christians and religiously unaffiliated people in 17 countries. In half of those countries, including the U.S., people who are not religiously affiliated are more likely than Christians to rate mortality or morality as bad. The data does appear to have a political element. In the U.S. and beyond, respondents who support the party out of power are more likely to see others as having bad morals. Pew's question might hint at effective polarization, says Dr. Jackson. This is deeper than political polarization. It's polarization based on what you think of others generally. In other words, do you feel a strong connection with like-minded people and strong negative emotions towards others? Data shows clearly that the U.S. has high and accelerating levels of effective polarization. In fact, Dr. Jackson says, when you overlay one respected study about effective polarization around the world on the Pew question, the rank order of countries roughly matches. The big outlier in that case is Canada, which normally scores lower, but Keith Newman, a senior associate at the Environics Institute, a Canadian polling firm, says that might be a matter of timing. The question from Pew was posed at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump took office, threatening to annex Canada. Canada was feeling an existential threat. That has a unifying tendency, says Dr. Newman. Founding philosophies. In many ways, the data reveals Indonesia as an interesting case study, says Dr. Lesage of Pew. In its global morality report, the survey asked respondents to consider the morality of 9 behaviors, including divorce, extramarital affairs, and gambling. Indonesia is among the strictest across the board, seeing almost all the behaviors as immoral. That might seem to indicate a society with harsh moral judgments of others. But the reverse is true. As in Canada, 92% of Indonesians saw their fellow Indonesians as somewhat moral or very moral. Part of that can be attributed to having the shared values of a dominant religion. Nearly 90% of Indonesians are a Muslim. Laws and institutions in Indonesia are still strongly influenced by religious values, although they are often paraphrased in more universal language, says Nadia Yovani, a sociologist at Universitas Indonesia in Depok. The Muslim concept of 5 daily prayers, she says, teaches discipline and regularity. This value of discipline is then reflected in social rules, such as the obligation to arrive on time at school or work, she adds. The same dynamic holds true in Sweden, though in a different way. Sweden ranked fourth in the Pew question, with 88% of Swedes saying other Swedes were somewhat good or very good morally. But that is based on a strong shared ethic grounded in secular humanism. Yet Indonesia has also done something else. Back in 1945, in an effort to unite the vast and culturally diverse archipelago into one nation, Indonesia's founders outlined an official state ideology known as Pancasila. Its five principles promote religious tolerance and embrace the moral traditions of all Indonesia's faiths. Today, references to Pancasila abound, from Jakarta gift shops to church facades in Borneo. For a heterogeneous society like Indonesia, Pancasila provides common ground that allows different groups to coexist, says Tubagus Haro Kabayanto, Secretary General of Forum Warga Kota, a non-governmental organization advocating on social issues. Dr. Yovani notes that at the end of Ramadan, when Muslims break a full month of fasting during the day, non-Muslims in Indonesia will often prepare the first celebratory meal for their Muslim neighbors. Pancasila touches on something deep in the Indonesian identity, others agree. Such traditions have long been part of everyday life, says Elfrida Manrurong, a postgraduate student at Indonesian Christian University in Jakarta. So, whether or not Pancasila exists, Indonesian society already has moral values inherited from its cultural heritage. Canada looks to similar historical influences. John Ralston Saul, a Canadian essayist and novelist, agrees that, well before Canada became a nation, it was constructed upon a triangular foundation of three distinct peoples, Indigenous, French, and English. And in an isolated northern climate, they all had to work together to survive. I am going to have to truncate that article because by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.